Hello, I'm Victoria.
And I'm Derek. This month we're focusing on questions of ethics. We'll be asking questions about the collection and use of consumer data and if it's ethical for scientists to experiment on themselves.
We'll also be dipping into some more of our events which celebrate the 350th anniversary of Philosophical Transactions when we hear some excerpts from a Dragon's Den fringe activity from the future of scholarly scientific communication.
But first, we dive into the possibilities for using consumer data.
Every day, corporations, governments, and other organizations collect vast amounts of data on our movements, our online habits, and our shopping preferences. These data can be used to predict and understand our lives in ways that we are only beginning to discover and understand. Last month, a policy lab meeting here at the Royal Society saw an expert panel tackle the question, consumer data, what's in store for you?
Representatives from the retail industry, research, ethics, and the law came together to explain what can be found out using seemingly uninteresting consumer data and how this can benefit society. They also discussed the ethical, legal, and privacy implications of these developments.
I'm Honora O'Neill, and I'm a philosopher who does some other things too, of a more public sort.
So I'm Professor of Health Law and Policy at the University of Oxford, and I direct the Centre for Health Law and Emerging Technologies, otherwise known as Helix.
Hello, yes. I'm Paul Longley. I'm Professor of Geographic Information Science at University College London, and I direct something called the Consumer Data Research Centre at University College London.
So I'm Giles Pavey. I'm the Chief Data Scientist at Dunnhumby, which I guess is one of the original big data companies. We've been doing that for 25 years now, looking at data and trying to do two things. One is understand people, and the second is help businesses to serve people better to meet that understanding.
Can you tell us a bit about the science behind customer science and what type of data you're looking at?
Of course. So what we do really is the coming together of three things. We are bringing together maths and statistics, but also a lot of computer science. And then always with the context of what is the situation that we're in, what's the business context, but also what's the social context, what's the acceptance. And we use those methods to analyze big data in all its forms, and increasingly to do that analysis in a real-time environment. So to look at the situation and give a recommendation or back within a matter of milliseconds.
So Professor Longley, can you sum up what the benefits are to consumers and society as a whole of researchers such as yourself being able to access and analyze consumer data? What's in it for us?
Okay. Many of our day-to-day activities generate data which are collected by the private sector. So consumer data are generated by our travel patterns, for example. They're generated by our energy consumption from private utility companies. Of course, our diet is determined by the food purchases that we make, and we leave traces of our purchases when we buy things either online or in conventional shopping centres. And so harvesting these data and reusing them to best effect allows us to plan rationally for travel. It allows us to design energy efficient communities and advise consumers how best to use energy. It enables devolved health authorities to link diet and well-being in a proactive way when we think about healthcare. And it also helps local authorities plan for the mix of activities that characterise our high streets and town centres, for example.
Okay. What needs to be done to strike the right balance between access to data for societal good and privacy, protection of privacy?
I think that obviously businesses have a real need to respect people's privacy. But beyond that, they have a real need to make sure that there's a fair value exchange between the data that's being given and the services that are being offered. So a lot of the work I'm involved in, or in fact all of the work I'm involved in, is about that value exchange. It might be monetary in terms of giving people offers on products that they buy, or it could be in terms of making the range in a shop more relevant, or the recommendations in on a website that bit better targeted so that they're more likely to be of interest to people.
So how can you sustain the individual confidence in participating in the digital economy?
I think what we need to do is have a legal framework which is robust, which we have in terms of data protection at the European level, and that's undergoing change. But I think that some of the changes are really very positive and give a lot of rights for individuals. But also, we need to make sure that people know that there are strong governance procedures in place, so that they know that if they give data, it's going to be used in the way that they have consented to, and also it's not going to be passed to the rest of the world. And then finally, I think we need sanctions, so that if there is a breach, or if something is done wrong that really affects an individual's privacy, then we have very clear sanctions, and the person who does that will be fined, or there will be other sanctions against them.
Regarding the new technological developments and the way data is more and more open, what are the main ethical issues that society should be concerned with?
I think we should be concerned about what is the fundamental point of privacy. And I would actually go to the European Convention on Human Rights rather than the justice who was cited. And it's fairly simple. A person's private life, home, family, and correspondence are what the right of privacy is about. So I would think those things are very important. I also think that we have learned quite a lot from the sociologists of 50 years ago, people like Irving Goffman, who wrote a book called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. People need to have a little bit of control over parts of their lives. So I think we know what privacy is about, while recognizing that the boundary is going to differ in one society and another, and even that some individuals will feel relaxed about being open about things that others don't feel relaxed about. But that control is the important thing for most people.
As well as tackling the ethical implications of collecting and storing our personal data, we tackled another ethical question this month. How should scientists conduct their research ethically? When they experiment on others? And what about when they experiment on themselves? At a Café Scientifique in April, we gathered experts for a panel discussion about the history of scientists experimenting on themselves. Kat Arney, a science communicator from Cancer Research UK, chaired the discussion. She asked the panel, are self-experimenters brave pioneers or dangerous lunatics? And is self-experimentation self-abuse or self-indulgence?
Kat was joined by Professor Holger Mailey, Professor of History of Medicine and Medical Ethics, Durham University, Dr. Gail Goldberg from the Elsie Widdowson Lab, and Dr. Duncan Wilson of the University of Manchester. We joined the discussion with Dr. Duncan Wilson talking about the birth of bioethics.
The very famous biologist J.B.S. Holding was an avid self-experimenter. As a child, he was sent down a mine by his father, J.S. Holding, to test the effects of fire damp on human lungs. That's poisonous gases that are emitted in mines. Lowered down into the mine, and on his father's instructions, recited lines from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar until he passed out. On passing out, lying on the floor, he realized he recovered quite quickly, which told him that while fire damp rises, oxygen stays below and you can recover from mine poisoning by lying on the floor. And Haldane wrote a paper on being one's own rabbit, in which he set out the reasons for self-experimentation. And one of those was that it was simply more convenient to experiment on yourself than it was, firstly, on animals, because you had to try and get a Home Office license. If you did any animal research without a Home Office license, you would be prosecuted. It was also more convenient than having to enroll participants, explain to them the risks of the procedure, try and get their consent if necessary. So there was pragmatic reasons. There was also sort of cultural and ethical reasons why Haldane and many of his peers experimented on themselves. Science, and especially biology in the early 20th century, was, to borrow a quote from Charlotte Haldane, J.B.S. Haldane's wife, a man's world. And it was a man's world that celebrated self-sacrifice and hardship. And Haldane and many others like him reveled in the fact that they would be the subjects of their own research and would expose themselves to considerable risk. Many, like J.B.S. Haldane, had fought in the First World War and survived the First World War. And to them, inoculating yourself with particular chemicals, inhaling particular gases, were far less arduous and dangerous than what they'd experienced in the trenches. But there was also a long-standing ethical principle that underlay their enthusiasm for self-experimentation. Scientists like Haldane and others believed it was immoral to expose patients or research subjects to procedures that they wouldn't undergo themselves. Haldane argued that the main reason for self-experimentation was to test on ourselves first that which we would have others do. And this ethical, moral justification for self-experimentation permeates science in the early 20th century. And it's also evident in the formulation of the most high-profile ethical code for scientific research in this period, which is the Nuremberg Code, which Holger has already mentioned. The Nuremberg Code was formulated in 1947 during the trial of Nazi doctors who had done horrific experiments on concentration camp prisoners during the Second World War. It was designed to prevent such abuses ever happening again. The most famous point of the Nuremberg Code, Article 1, is that the informed consent of the volunteer is absolutely essential to any research. Less well known is Article 5. Article 5 of the Nuremberg Code states that no experiment shall be conducted where there is a reason to believe that death or disabling injury will occur. Fair enough. But then it goes on, except perhaps in those experiments where the experimental physicians also serve as subjects. And this principle of do unto others as you would have them do unto you goes unchallenged really until the 1960s and the 1970s. And it is challenged by the emergence of what we call bioethics. And bioethics is the outside scrutiny of scientific and medical procedures by lawyers, by philosophers, by theologians, by social scientists. And it emerged in the 1960s and the 1970s following documented abuses of research done on vulnerable populations. So institutionalized children in asylums, African-American populations in the American South. So really, it showed that the Nuremberg Code was ignored by a large proportion of the biomedical community. Now, bioethicists weren't specifically bothered about self-experimentation per se at the beginning, but they were concerned with whether the Golden Rule was an appropriate moral guide. One person who wrote very early on the Golden Rule was Bernard Williams. And in a 1967 article for the BBC's Listener magazine, reviewing a book by Maurice Papworth called Human Guinea Pigs, Williams scrutinised the Golden Rule and the issue of self-experimentation. He argued that the Golden Rule was in fact the pyrite rule, or the fool's gold rule, because doing unto others what you would do to yourself is dangerous because it presumes a form of equality that doesn't exist in reality. What Williams argued was that the doctor may be plausibly convinced that he himself, his family, and his friends would be prepared to put up with a lot for science. But in making that presumption, he doesn't know what other people are prepared to put up with. No one, Williams continued, doctor's family or anyone else, will count as being in the same circumstances unless they have just the same hopes, fears, trusts, and beliefs. And Williams argued that even in cases where the self, where the experimenter was undergoing a procedure themselves, the procedure and the research should be subject to ethical review by ethics committees that were beginning to emerge in universities during the 70s. And they argued that this should apply to research even when the scientist was the only subject.
You can hear the rest of the speakers at the event and questions from the audience on our website. Just search for Science on Myself. You can also find audio from lots of our other past events by searching on our website.
In April and May, as part of the Publishing 350 programme to mark 350 years of philosophical transactions, the Society held high-level debates on the future of how science will be communicated, whether that's in journals or by some other means. For some light relief, and with the hope that a more relaxed environment could be just as fruitful in providing innovative new ideas, a fringe Dragon's Den event was held, asking participants for their solutions to potential flaws in how scientific journals currently operate. Here you can listen to some of the highlights.
Thank you very much. So I'm Roger Highfield. I'm with the Science Museum, and welcome to the Dragon's Den. If you are successful, you will be immortalized in the official rapporteur's report of this meeting. Isn't that amazing? Now, we've got three brilliant dragons here. First of all, Baroness O'Neill. We've got Anita de Ward. And third, we've got Ben Goldacre. So each of the pitchers will have just 100 seconds each to sell their idea to the dragons. And then finally, we'll select on various criteria, whether it's being innovative, practical, or useful, the best idea. The first pitcher is Cameron Nalon, the advocacy director of PLOS. Cameron, your 100 seconds starts now.
Okay, so we've kept hearing about culture and credit and incentives. We kept coming back to this point over the 3 days we've been. So I look forward to the election of the first Royal Society Fellow on the basis of their contribution to refereeing and data curation.
Yeah. Excellent. Now, what I like about that was well under 100 seconds, which is, you can always be much shorter. So take a seat, and let's now go on to Kate Hendry, Royal Society University Research Fellow from the University of Bristol. Kate, your 100 seconds starts now.
Okay, I would like to promote the idea of a bit of software I am going to call OneRev. And Rev does not stand for revolutionary, no, it stands for review, because I'm not planning to revolutionise the system just to have something plausible that might change it for the better. Able to link up with the other reviewers of a manuscript online and discuss the manuscript live.
Mike Taylor, who's actually been blogging away like mad during not only today but a couple of weeks ago, programmer with a PhD in paleontology. Mike, your 100 seconds starts now.
I'd like to address a very practical problem. It's not as fundamental as these other ones. And it's this. It's 21 years now since Stephen Harned's subversive proposal to make manuscripts freely available on various sites around the world. And the problem we have, although this has largely happened, we have at least 4,000 known institutional repositories that are indexed, is there's no way to search across all of them. I have a very practical solution to fixing this. It actually exists in demo form. In my day job, I'm a software engineer, and my employer has given me leave to work on this. And we can search all of these things by a combination of live searching, which works immediately and is quick and cheap to set up, but runs potentially quite slowly and is limited in what kind of filtering and sorting it can do. Combination of that and harvesting.
Question, I think, because I think your idea is brilliant, boring, and necessary. No, but it's important. It's information architecture grunt work. Software made by academics is often terrible. So why would I give you £4 million instead of somebody else?
Precisely. Ooh. Because I'm only a spare time academic in my. My day job, I am a software engineer. Now, we have a whole stack of software that this is built on.
But everybody gets very cross when you try and apply metrics to the quality of science. How are you going to apply metrics to the quality of reviews, and how will you do that any better?
I'm just going to change the criteria for election to the Royal Society. No metrics, no nothing.
How would you deal with time zone problems? You've got your reviewers in different time zones, and it seems they've got to be accessible to one another simultaneously. Thank you.
I think, Dragons, let's just have a couple of minutes of questions from the audience before we get the next pitchers to come in. Now, David Vaux over there is desperate to ask a question. And obviously, it'd be lovely, maybe if we could have, you know, one for Mike, one for Kate, one for Cameron, but let's see how we get on.
Well, to comment on this thing, I like to read and review papers in the bath, and I was wondering how that...
Well, I should definitely be encouraged.
Well, the discussion's taken a very interesting turn, and we're starting off with Eileen Fife, historian of science with a specialist interest in publishing from the University of St Andrews. Eileen, you have your 100 seconds. Fire away.
OK, thank you. What I would like to see is the Royal Society and the other learned societies taking the lead in doing something to reform the current model of publishing. I would like to see the learned societies jointly, and in collaboration it would have to be with the funders and the universities, deciding to put all their articles open access and with no APCs.
Now, another blogger, Stephen Curry of Imperial College London. Fire away, Stephen.
Thank you. I have taken off my jacket and rolled up my sleeves because that's how you indicate that you are pumped up by your ideas. And I am pumped up by my proposals today. So I actually have two ideas for you, both of which are aiming to disable the pernicious effects of the impact factor. And we've heard an awful lot about the ill effects of that particular metric at this meeting already. So the first proposal came to me actually in a flash of genius on Sunday, quite spontaneously, and it is to erect an 8-foot limestone slab at the entrance to every single university department inscribed with the words, if we use the impact factor to evaluate research or researchers, then we are statistically illiterate. So the best thing I think we can do is to bring down the system from the inside by a small but innocuous proposal, which is based on sweet reasonableness. And I think we can do that by appealing to scientists' sense of their investment in data and in complexity. And we can do that by mandating that all journals, as well as advertising their impact factor, publish the citation distributions on which those impact factors are
last
based.
Last but not least, David Calhoun of UCL, our last pitcher. David, you have 100 seconds. Fire away.
Okay, a few premises. Richard Smith was completely right. Peer review is absolutely broken. There's a handful of specialist journals where it works quite well, but by and large, with, 1.8 million papers a year and 30,000 journals, of course it's broken. There are no people around with the expertise
wasting
money on doing rankings which pressurise people. But now the more constructive suggestion, because they'll die out anyway, I think, eventually. At least I hope so.
They do make the trains run on time.
clearly, the future is post-publication peer review. So what you want is just something like pingbacks on a WordPress blog. WordPress can do it. Sure, the Royal Society can do it. The last step will actually become redundant, I think, eventually. The proper journal, it won't be needed. The archive will be it.
So what you're proposing is making it more easily available, or putting up a mandate to say all journals need to share the citation of each and every article.
Journals do it as a service to the community and demonstrating their integrity.
You're trying to mandate journals
or
to publish a piece of information in a way that actively undermines their own credibility.
No, why? Why does it undermine their credibility? I mean, what have they got to hide? Either they do it, or we do it for them. That's the idea.
And they're hiding it very well.
Well, as we've discussed at this meeting, they're hiding it extraordinarily well.
To Stefan again.
Okay, so Mike Taylor was next. With his system, which I don't think I understood fully, but it sounded very, very interesting. It was it's to make it's a combination of search and harvesting. So it was actually. It's XML over HTTP.
We can't have new pitches again.
It's solving the problem of all the different repositories being fragmented.
Okay, let's have another show of hands for Mike's idea. Oh, that's quite
sizable.
I'm going to let Stefan do the counting.
Yeah, 35, 36, 37.
Okay.
Counts are not very accurate.
Are you sure?
It's a little risky. Augmented. How's that?
Okay, look, there we go. So we thought that Mike, David and Cameron had sensible, deliverable ideas, which had all been, to an extent, already done. or at least some basic infrastructure existed around them. And in particular, Mike and
Dave. But have we got one winner or two winners here? I'm confused now.
Well, we're all winners, really.
Oh, dear. Come on, let's have a first past the post.
I think Mike can integrate David's proposal. How is that? For maybe a £500,000.
It's Mike tells it's yes. Mike.
I'm going to... Well, okay, here we are. There's most
Mike.
Yes, Mike.
Okay, Mike.
As usual, we're wrapping up this month's episode with that all-important question, why science? We caught up with experts Giles Pavey, Jane Kay, and Honora O'Neill at our policy lab meeting on consumer data to find out what they find fascinating about science.
I've been around science all my life. Maybe I wasn't cut out to be a physicist, which is where I started, but the scientific method of building a hypothesis, testing a hypothesis, is just fantastic for me. It's my job is a joy, and that is because being able to use fantastic techniques to understand human behaviour, and then, as I say, to make things better.
Because I think it's really interesting when you bring the law together with science, cutting-edge science, where things are really changing, you really start to have some interesting things happening. So I'm really interested in the way that we govern new technologies. And so by working in the field of science and health, I can bring legal perspectives into actually thinking about some of the big challenges that are associated with cutting-edge science.
Why science? Because that is a method of finding out complicated empirical truths. Why only science? Not only science, because you can't do science without ethics. If you think you could do science without ethics, you have to wonder, why would I have to be honest about the data? So now I've broadened the question. Why do we want rigorous approaches to knowledge? Well, we want it because it gives us understanding, wonder, and control of parts of our world and our lives, but to do it we need science and ethics. So we need empirical claims and normative claims. I'm not going to compress it any more than that.
That brings us to the end of this month's Our Science episode. Join us again next month when we'll be talking about the exceptional scientists and their science which have won our awards this year. Thanks for listening.